Good morning and welcome. Welcome to the slippery slope of lipids and other medical issues. This program is brought to you by the Triana Prevention Center in Port Charlotte, Florida. And for the next hour, you'll have the chance to call and interact with this live medical talk show. If you would like to join the conversation by asking a question or offering a comment, phone lines are now open, 941-206-1580 or 888-441-1580. And now here's your host of the show, Dr. Elizabeth Triana. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Todd. And we have a wonderful guest today. I'm very proud. I'll introduce him in 1 minute because I'm so excited. Anyways, I want to tell everybody, I want to thank so much. Last week we had Dr. Madeira, and she was a wonderful guest. And today we have a cardiologist, Dr. Paul Popper, who has been, I would say, a pioneer here in bringing state-of-the-art medical cardiology care to our community. I am so proud that he's here today and so excited. Welcome, Dr. Popper.
Well, Dr. Triana, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. You and I have known each other for many years, and it's nice to be able to interact with the people here in Charlotte County. Having been here for quite a while, I'm excited and glad to be here.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You know, Dr. Popper has been here for 30 years. Wow. I thought you were just 21. I mean, you look great. 30 years.
It's amazing. None of, we certainly don't look our age.
I know we don't.
Yeah, no.
But so tell us, how did you come to Charlotte County?
It was perfectly obvious. When I was previously working up in Philadelphia, I had a cardiology practice at one of the large institutions in Philadelphia, and I decided I wanted to leave the city, and I drove the Tamiami Trail. I flew into Tampa and drove around to Miami to attend an American Heart Association meeting and identified a few places I wanted to live. And I drove over the bridge over the Charlotte Harbor, and there was a thunderstorm going on up river and a sailboat race going on in the harbor. And I realized this is where I wanted to be.
Oh, my goodness. That is wonderful. It is. Every time I go over the bridge, I said, it's so beautiful here.
I love it. It's marvelous. Luckily, at the time also, we were just in the process of innovating some cardiology care. This county had no cath labs, cardiac catheterization labs at that time. So over the next year, we got a certificate of need to open the cath lab and opened up the facility and developed the heart program that became the multiple award-winning heart program at Charlotte Regional at the time, now moved to Peace River.
Right. Oh, I remember my own father had bypass surgery at Charlotte Regional, and they did just a wonderful care. We still have the pillow that... You know, they gave you a pillow that you hold.
Yeah.
We still have that pillow. And, you know, my dad's in heaven, but we still have that pillow. And I remember the great care. And it was, even though I'm a doctor, it was very emotional to see your father intubated after surgery. But he came out of it great.
Yeah, the things we do can be difficult for people who are not... used to seeing that kind of stuff. The instrumentation and the manipulation of the human body that we've learned to use these marvelous techniques can look pretty gruesome.
Well, but every time you have to think it's going to save a life or help make your life better.
Well, we hope so.
That we do hope so. So your practice, I just love the name of your practice. It's called the Center for Performing Hearts in Port Charlotte.
Here in Port Charlotte. Center for the Performing Hearts.
For the performing hearts. Yes.
It came to me in a moment of lucidity early in the morning in a dream, I believe, years ago. And we've always enjoyed the concept of helping heal hearts, also fixing broken hearts, as we like to think of it. And it's a pleasure to be able to help people down that road to where they have been fixed.
Right. Well,
and are healthy once again.
Well, that's what, you know, I'm like we were talking earlier, I'm trying to prevent an event, but you say many of your patients have had numerous events.
Yeah, as we were speaking a few moments ago, we're kind of on the different end of the process of treating people with arteriosclerotic disease that develops into the cholesterol buildup and plaque in the various artery beds in the heart, leading to the brain, leading to the kidneys and the arms and legs. In my practice, my average patient, as I mentioned before, has an average of 4 cardiovascular events.
Wow.
They've had an average of 4 of the various heart attacks, strokes, bypass surgery, angioplasty, need for a pacemaker, peripheral vascular and renal vascular disease. So these patients are very focused on the need to aggressively treat their cardiac disease. You have the opportunity of preventing so many people from going down that road to needing that type of aggressive care. And luckily in today's world, we're still acquiring but have acquired a tremendous amount of insight and knowledge into how to control the risk factors that go into someone developing these processes later in life.
I think that's so important for people to understand. And part of the way we discover patients' risk is by doing certain tests, which sometimes people don't want to do anything.
Well, you know, as you mentioned, asked me a question that led to a discussion, what we want to accomplish in medicine, and we want to accomplish people being participants in the decision-making process of how to improve their health.
Right.
Now, certainly when somebody's having a heart attack, the participation they need is to get themselves to an emergency room. But before that, they can make decisions that will help prevent this process by learning enough basic information about themselves, often through these relatively simple testing procedures that enable them to know whether they're at risk for these diseases or not.
For example, you were saying just knowing your family history. I'm surprised that so many people have no clue about their brothers and sisters or parents. My family is originally from Cuba, so everything is family, family, family.
Yeah, I mean, there are many simple ways of achieving this knowledge. Certainly, going to see a physician who's able to give you some insight into how to do it is a place to start. In today's world, we have a tremendous amount of useful information on the internet. We have a tremendous amount of bull on the internet.
Disuseful information.
But you have to identify the sites that give you reliable information.
Right.
We know that there are professional institutions who are dedicated to the reliability of this, as opposed to the often rumor mongering other types of sources.
That is so true. I don't know if anyone would like to call in and ask a question at 206-1580. And I want to let everybody know that we're now on Facebook. So you can like the Slippery Slope of Lipids on Facebook if you would like to, or make a comment. So what, you know, we had a patient and he described from the patient perspective when he had a heart attack. Could you describe it from your perspective? What is a heart attack?
Well, first of all, a heart attack basically is your heart attacking you. It's a major malfunction of the heart. We think of mostly an obstruction in one of the arteries of the heart. The majority of heart attacks are caused by the cholesterol lipid buildup in the wall of the artery that eventually closes off an artery that leads to a portion of the muscle of the heart. That section of muscle then loses its oxygen and metabolite supply because the blood supply is cut off, and those heart muscle cells then proceed to die. A myocardial infarction,
right,
basically is Latin meaning heart muscle cells die. So that section of the heart muscle then loses its blood supply. The symptoms can be extremely variable. As many as one-third of all heart attacks are asymptomatic, a silent heart attack. Mm-hmm. A patient may feel some nebulous feeling of discomfort or unease, may think they have ate something bad or a flu, just feel poorly. They go to see their doctor a year later, doctor does an electrocardiograph, and notices that there's been a dramatic change. So this person may have had a totally asymptomatic heart attack. Another third of people have what we consider to be atypical symptoms. Many people having a heart attack come to the emergency room with the worst darn bellyache of their life.
Ooh.
Or the worst back pain they've ever felt. Or a feeling in their jaw, something that is not particularly related to the discomfort in the chest that we think of as the typical symptoms of a heart attack. So you've got one-third of people who have no symptoms whatsoever, a third of people who have think they have non-cardiac problems, and then a third of people who have what we think of as the typical symptoms, the Fred Sanford grabbing your chest, I'm coming. Was it Elizabeth? Elizabeth. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. Take my word on that.
What show was this?
Sanford and Son. Before
really?
Your time, obviously.
No. I didn't know that he had a heart attack.
Red Fox, the comedian in the 1970s.
Yes. Yeah.
Every time he had trouble, he grabbed his heart. You hear that, Elizabeth? I'm coming to join you, honey, because his wife had passed on. You see?
Oh.
But he had it all too frequently and for all the wrong reasons.
I remember Morticia and the Adams family fainting. Oh.
Well, perhaps she had mitral valve prolapse.
Yes.
We don't know. But, so these typical symptoms of someone grabbing their chest and feeling a horrible pressure in their chest as if an elephant is sitting on their chest, feeling short of breath, getting lightheaded, being unable to breathe comfortably. These are the typical symptoms of what we know to be of a heart attack, but only a minority of people have them, which leads to the understanding that some people develop symptoms leading up to a heart attack. They start having angina, a chest squeezing pressure,
right,
relating to a slow progression of the arterial disease. But those people that have silent heart disease have no warning symptoms whatsoever. They have the silent progression of the disease to the point where it's so severe that they may experience what we refer to as sudden death, simply because they didn't know it was coming on. So the majority of heart attacks are caused by the progression of arteriosclerotic disease caused,
right,
by the lipids. Some of the heart attacks, however, are arrhythmia-based. There's no severe arterial disease, but one experiences a spontaneous and sudden bad heart rhythm that can be as fatal as anything else.
You know, I think that's really important. A lot of people don't seem to understand what is there's a separation between, and yet integrated, the electrical conduction system of the heart and the muscles. If you could go over that, because, and it's just so important. Like you said, an arrhythmia can cause a heart attack.
Well, you're right. I often analogize the heart with the internal combustion engine of your car. The heart has chambers, as your engine has cylinders. It has valves. Both of them have valves that control the flow of liquids. There is an electrical conduction system of your heart, not unlike the electrical conduction system of your car, that gets the electrical spark to the various chambers at the right times for them to fire and contract. And it organizes the lub-dub of your heart to be a steady lub-dub in a regular fashion, and works just like the electrical system of your car. And in fact, when we dissect out a heart, something that is done on a regular basis, looking for the causes of these problems, you can identify the electrical conduction system. It is a wiring system with insulation around it to keep it out of keep the electrical activity within the wire until it gets to the point where the electrical activity is supposed to come out from the wiring. So it's a uniform and easily identifiable anatomical structure within your heart. The abnormal heart rhythms that we experience are tremendously variable. Many people have, almost everybody has some degree of benign arrhythmia. But many people, as we age, develop some pretty serious stuff that can affect the function of your heart, can affect your life, and can cause damage to other organs as well.
And if you have to look at each, you look at it, you can. There's different tests that we do, such as an echocardiogram to look at the anatomy and function of the heart, or a Holter monitor, a 24-hour monitor to look at the electrical conduction system. Sometimes people think, oh, I just had an EKG. Isn't that enough?
Well, that's a 12-second analysis of your heart rhythm.
I know. I'm just...
And certainly an EKG gives us some useful information. We've been doing EKGs since the 1850s and 60s, when a fellow in Germany by the name of Einthoven put people's hands and feet in buckets of water and measured the differences in the electrical potential between those areas. And that was the first electrocardiograph. We call it an EKG, but in English there's no K in electrocardiograph. It goes back to the German, which there is. So that is a very primitive test, an ancient test, that gives us lots of good information today, over 150 years later. The echocardiogram, an ultrasound test using the ultrasound that penetrates into the heart, and now Doppler measurements,
right,
give us a tremendous amount of information from outside your body about how your heart's working, how the valves are working, and the tissues around the heart. These things are painless, easy to do. The Holter monitor that you mentioned, being a 24-hour assessment of heart rhythm, gives us a tremendous greater amount of information than that 12-second EKG. All of these things are supplementary to each other. They complement each other in our ability to understand how any particular patient's heart is functioning.
I think it's really important to reemphasize is that one-third of people don't feel a heart attack. And you were saying the other third have atypical symptoms. So I feel that way ahead of time, we need to, like you were saying, assess the person's risk it to prevent them from developing what they may not know will happen.
That seems perfectly clear to us, doesn't it? Unfortunately, there are many that... in our society that seem not to want to know these things.
Yes, I know. So there's some people that want to, or there's some actually either insurance companies or people who don't want to monetarily pay for this. But I always tell my patients, so much, the more information I have about you, the better I can take care of you. The better we can make a plan of action. And that's what we do at the Triana Prevention Center. I mean, and sometimes you have to convince people. I mean, you've already seen them after they've already had the elephant sitting on the chest. And you're saying, I'm going to help you, and I'm going to help you to live longer. And we always say here, more good years to be with the people you love. I mean, it's so important. It's just so important. One of the questions we get a lot about people who do have heart attacks is, once they have the heart attack, what can they do with their lives? Will they be able to have sex? Will they be able to go back to work? If you could talk to us about that.
Well, that time of when you have a heart attack separates the principles of treatment quite dramatically. Prior to having an event, we refer to it as primary prevention. So we're in the process of attempting to prevent the first event.
Right.
After the first event, we refer to it as secondary prevention. And the principles we use to deal with people who have risk factors but no previous events, and those that we treat, the principles that we use for their treatment afterwards, are somewhat different. And usually, it's amazing when you'll ask people, when did your life change? When did this particular lifestyle process stop? When did you quit smoking?
Right.
When did you start exercising? Well, frequently it's after their first heart attack. So it's important to try and certainly prevent the second heart attack from happening. And that group of people is different. Once you've had the first event, you have a disease. You have a disease process that will be lifelong. You're no longer trying to simply prevent in the absence of knowledge of having the disease. So once you know that you have the disease, as I say, we use different principles. Can a heart patient get back to doing all of these things? Overwhelmingly.
Wonderful.
Overwhelmingly, your lifestyle can get back to doing just about anything you want it to. Many of the patients, after a heart attack, we'll put them through rehab, an exercise program. And they'll want to know what I can do, I can exercise. And I'll frequently tell them, you could run a marathon. You just can't run it tomorrow.
Okay.
It will take you months to slowly work up to the point where possibly you could run a marathon. Some of these people have never done exercise before, as you know. It becomes an important modality in changing their lifestyle. When they get back to having sex, obviously, is very important for an overwhelming majority of folks. And it has something to do with your exercise potential and capacity and how you get back to those things one at a time. Because it can be a lot of exercise.
Yes.
So while it is possible that you'll be having sex in the future, you might not want to be doing it two or three times tomorrow. So that progression of changing your lifestyle, getting back to doing the things that you may never have done before but need to be doing now, is a progression. And it's part of the recovery aspect of having had an event.
That's very, very important for people to understand that we can continue to live after we have an event, but yet we can do something to prevent the secondary event, and we can prevent the first event. That's what my biggest stress is too. So the other question I had for you was, in terms of, there's so much going on about the arrhythmias. You see, like atrial fibrillation, and what is atrial fibrillation? People don't seem to understand the concept.
Well, as we're living longer, the original manufacturer probably had specs on the human being to last long enough to have children, make sure they were on their own and get out of the way, which we've overcome in the last several decades. So when the human body was originally designed, living to 30, 40, maybe 50 was appropriate.
Right.
And good for the race, but now we're living longer. We're living into the 60s, 70s, routinely 80s. People expect anymore to live into those later decades. As we live longer, things start to break down. And the insulation around the wiring of your heart, and the wiring itself tends to break down. In the same process of degeneration that leads us to for wrinkles and white hair and all of the other processes, those tissues no longer work as well as they used to. So we develop abnormal heart rhythms because the electrical signals from your natural pacemaker, we're all born with a pacemaker.
Right.
The original signal from your pacemaker that's conducted through the electrical conduction system no longer gets to the right place at the right times. You get short circuits and escaped electrical activity. And that leads to these abnormal heart rhythms. Atrial fibrillation has become the most common abnormal heart rhythm in the world today, simply because people are living long enough to develop it. It has multiple consequences. Some people feel it, many don't.
Right.
The consequences are that it does cause your heart to race sometimes and to beat abnormally. It can lead to a reduced function of your heart. Your heart no longer pumps as effectively as it did because its coordination is thrown off, and that can lead to heart failure and enlargement of the heart, even alone in the absence of other disease. It also, its most serious consequence, unfortunately, is that of strokes. As the heart fibrillates, which is simply a Latin word meaning to twitch, so atrial fibrillation essentially means the atria, which is the upper chambers of the heart, twitch instead of beating. When they're twitching, you can develop little blood clots inside your heart, and at sometimes they can break loose and go anywhere in your body, the most devastating events being that of stroke. So with someone who is in atrial fibrillation, they have somewhere between 3 to 5 times the chance of having a stroke in any year as someone who does not have atrial fibrillation. So those, as people know, the consequences of stroke can be devastating to a person's life. They can be life-ending. The most horrible thing sometimes is that when they're not life-ending, they cause tremendous...
disability.
Tremendous disability in our society. And we have a way to control these things, so we try to... help people understand what's going on with those rhythms. We try to control the rhythms. And of course, we have today in today's world some very modern blood thinners. We no longer have to use as much rat poison as we used to.
By the way, that's Coumadin. people don't realize that Coumadin, that was what originally was.
Yeah, yeah. A wonderful DuPont product that we can buy in the store in those brown boxes with the little blue stuff inside of it, and we put down for our rodents. But in a well-monitored medical program is also tremendous in reducing the possibility of someone in atrial fibrillation having a stroke almost back down to a normal range.
You know, I've had patients come to me and be in atrial fibrillation and not want to do anything about it. And I'm like in shock because your risk of developing a stroke increases so much. And I tell people that it's, you know, unfortunately, we're all going to leave this planet, okay? But the thing is, we know that, but we don't want to be disabled. I think disability is the scariest thing.
Well, we've all heard horror stories relating to medicines. One rarely goes online and finds the story about a stroke that didn't happen or a heart attack that didn't happen.
That's true.
So on the other hand, you can find stories of the events that did happen. So we know that by treating with these medicines that have potentially serious side effects and can actually cause problems. But we know that if you give them to 1,000 people that have a particular problem and do not give them to 1,000 people that don't, the event rate is so dramatically reduced in those people getting therapy that it makes it worth doing.
Case in point, statins.
Statins, also a marvelous medicine, one of the miracles of the latter half of the last century, that have some potential side effects. However, when used appropriately and monitored appropriately, are incredibly safe and reduce the frequency of disease dramatically.
Dramatically.
Now, you know, for me, as we've pointed out, when I'm dealing with someone that has had events, they're real easy to convince that something needs to be done to prevent the next one. It's more difficult to take someone that has not had an event and convince them that they need to be on a drug, a medicine.
Right.
But the statins are one of the miracles of our medical care delivery system of the last 50 years.
You know, I did a whole program on the history of statins and how they were discovered. The Japanese Akira Endo, and it was a fascinating story. But you're right. It is incredible that so many medicines that can prevent, such as a statin, prevent an event, many people, and you even see this with people with high blood pressure, but I feel good, they say. I feel good. I don't want to take a pill. Oh, your blood pressure is high. I mean, I'm sure you have seen that, though.
Of course. And you'll feel good until you don't.
Right.
And when you don't, it's becoming too late. So high blood pressure previously was known as the silent killer.
Yes.
When I was in medical school that long ago, blood pressure was relatively poorly treated, referred to as the silent killer because one didn't get a warning sign until you were close to death. And the reason for that is that blood pressure, like other processes, can ravage your body, cause multiple areas of damage to many of your important organs without you knowing there's a problem. The symptoms of blood pressure, by and large, are silent until organ failure starts occurring.
And in many disease processes, it's like that too. People don't feel anything. They feel good until they have the end organ damage or the end event.
And therefore, the importance of regular evaluation of your risk factors. Therefore, the importance of getting your blood pressure taken
right
by someone that knows how to do it on an occasional basis. The importance of doing these routine evaluations. We certainly don't know everything about disease, and we certainly have not perfected life never ending. But we certainly know how to identify a large number of the processes that can shorten our life. And by monitoring for them and looking for those risk factors that we can treat, you can do a much better job of taking care of yourself.
That's true. And I just want to remind everybody, we have a caller.
I was just going to ask if you were interested in
yes.
talking to the audience. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello there.
Hello, caller.
I have a question. Can you hear me all right? I'm on a cell phone.
Yes. I can hear you.
Yeah. I'm 79. My wife is 77. We live in the Rotunda area. Thank God we never had any of those symptoms yet. But we're right on, we're getting up in age, like you were saying. People live in the 80s. Now I'm close to 80. If anything ever happened, like if I got those symptoms, like a heart attack or something, what do I do? I mean, where do I go, or who do you call, or you follow what I'm trying to say?
Yes, I do. Yeah, and this
absolutely.
Is,
yes. We follow it. And my first question is, are you calling to make an appointment?
No, I tell you, I'm like those other people. I feel pretty good. I try and watch my cholesterol, and I'm taking statins for cholesterol and for sugar. I'm not overweight. I used to be 5'9". I'm only like 149 pounds, so I'm not overweight or nothing. But if something ever happened to my wife or myself, what do? Do we just call 911 and let them take us any special place or what?
Well, I'll let the cardiologist, Dr. Popper, answer that, but I thought that was a very good first answer, too.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I believe it important that you have a primary health care deliverer who knows you. Obviously, if you're on medical treatment for some of these metabolic disease processes, you have a primary care deliverer who knows your history, knows your background.
Yeah, we have a DO right now.
Well, that's...
So, you know, I guess he would know, but, I mean, when you have the symptoms, do you call him first, or do you call 911, or do you call hospital? Which hospital would be the best for this area? We're in Rotunda.
Certainly, sir, it depends upon your symptoms, obviously. One doesn't call 911 for every medical concern.
Right. But, I mean, we've never called them.
But certainly, if you have a serious, if you're concerned that you have a serious problem going on, if you think about emergency care, then you dial 911. Absolutely. That's what it's for. That's why we've established this system. If you're thinking, should I be calling an ambulance, you probably ought to call an ambulance.
Right.
Now that, you know, on the other hand, it's important that you understand what your risks of having certain things are and that you approach that reasonably and intelligently. We don't want the emergency rooms flooded with people having minor problems. But on the other hand, if you're so concerned about a symptom that you're experiencing, that you're thinking about it, you ought to do it.
And the other thing to remember, and I thank you, caller, for calling, that Triana...
Do we tell the 941, and they come, do we tell them to take us to a certain hospital?
The emergency services have the principles of service. They will evaluate you and determine what hospital they should be taking you. The services have their instructions as to how to deal with certain problems. And by and large, if you are having a serious emergency problem, they will get you to the closest emergency room. It is rare that a person who has a life-threatening process will be driven by an emergency room that could help stabilize them. On the other hand, if you're stable and there's some discussion, they'll give you the information as to what hospitals are available.
Okay. Thank you for the call, sir.
Thank you, caller. And I just want to remind everybody that this is Dr. Elizabeth Triana, and our guest is Dr. Paul Popper from the Center for the Performing Arts. And he's in Port Charlotte. What's your phone number, Dr. Popper?
The phone number is 625-6223 at the Center for the Performing Arts.
Which is, I just love that. And he has a great team. Him and we had as our guest, Deborah Dunham, a nurse practitioner, are such an incredible team. And she was a wonderful guest also, just like you've been such a great guest. I mean, I feel like the time has just flown. It's been wonderful. And we have another caller.
Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Good morning. Can you give me the pros and cons of one aspirin a day with a meal?
Interesting question, sir. For many years, we've really felt that, I'm assuming you're talking now about primary prevention, not secondary.
Correct, that is correct.
Okay. So for decades now, we felt that an aspirin is effective in helping prevent cardiovascular events. Not so clear. Recently, a couple of fairly large population-based studies suggest that it may not be as useful and effective as we think. With the advent of computerizing all of the information relating to Medicare and other health insurance information and hospital information, we're getting large amounts of information covering millions of patients Now, this is not refined information, but useful information to help us understand some population-based questions. And one of these large evaluations of patients who had not previously had heart attacks, who were taking aspirin or not taking aspirin, didn't seem to have any significant difference in the frequency of their events. So the importance of primary prevention is gray at this point. Many people still take it. There doesn't seem to be any downside to it.
Well, that's a good thing. There's really no negative to it. I mean, not just in reference to your heart, and I was told keeping your blood thin and all that good stuff. They say the benefits of aspirin are many.
Well, in fact, aspirin is a minor antiplatelet agent. It prevents platelets from being so active in the blood clot process. Therefore, we refer to it as a blood thinner, but in fact, your blood's no thinner. The viscosity of your blood does not change. Even with major blood thinners such as Coumadin or the more modern blood thinning agents, the viscosity of the blood doesn't change, so it doesn't flow any thinner. What it does is slow down the clotting process, which occurs when there's an abnormality in your in contact with your bloodstream. So we do refer to it as a thinner, but the blood ain't no thinner.
But there's really not really any negatives as far as any other aspects of the body.
That's correct, especially if you're taking it with a meal or if you're taking coated aspirin. The only potential downside is irritation of the stomach. If you have a tendency for gastritis or ulcers, it can irritate your stomach a little, but certainly not with the coated or taking it with a meal. There's no evidence that that's a downside.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, caller. Really appreciate that. What dosage of aspirin were they looking at?
This was not a structured study.
Oh, it was just, okay.
Just the presence of it. The majority of people are taking one or two baby aspirin a day, that being 81 or 162 milligrams of aspirin. It's unclear the significance of it. Our belief that it's helpful was based on unclear evidence as well. So nobody has ever really identified it as being so important. Yet it's out there in the population taking it all the time.
And it's been around for eons.
Yep. And I'm certainly not at any point now suggesting people not take it.
Right. It's a gray area.
But it is no longer as cut and dry as it used to.
I think that's really important. That's our mission in this program, is to let people think. I think what you were saying before, I had asked you, where, if there's one take-home message you to give to patients or to our wonderful radio audience, which I'm very blessed that we do have a wonderful radio audience, to take home, I think what you had said before is so important.
And it took me a few moments, actually, to consider that very fairly deep philosophical question. And the take-home point is to be participant in your care. To be participant in everything in life is important. If you're going to choose a job, if you're going to buy a house, if you're going to buy a car, you want to learn something about the process. If you're going to start a retirement plan, you want to learn something about what's right for you. Your health is no different. It's important to learn enough about it so that your desires, your wishes can be part of the process. You should be participant in your health care decisions, educating your patient, which I know you do, because we do share many patients.
Yes.
Educating your patient is very important, allowing them to express their opinions within the understanding of what's going on is very important.
We have another caller.
Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I've had a pacemaker now for over 4 years. But before I got the pacemaker, all my physical checkups showed no diabetes, now that I've got a pacemaker, it shows up that I'm diabetic. Is there any correlation between that?
Yeah, it's been 4 years. You're four years older, sir.
Yes.
Most people are not diabetic until they develop diabetes. I don't know you personally, but no. Aside from the smart answer, there is no correlation whatsoever with the pacemaker and your development of a metabolic process such as that, sir.
Okay, thank you.
But remember that, and we've stressed before, Dr. Popper is correct, but if you're a diabetic now, you've had insulin resistance, which is what we detect at the Triana Prevention Center, and we try to prevent you from getting diagnosed to be a diabetic, and you've already had, at least by 10 to 15 years, this metabolic process ongoing, which then becomes the diagnosis of diabetes. So that's the whole idea of prevention, is finding it out way ahead of time.
And in fact, we know that the end organ damage that diabetes can cause, diabetes is still the number one cause of blindness and kidney failure in the world today. Luckily, it's not so in this country. But in the world outside, especially in the third world, blood sugar, diabetes is the most common cause of those diseases. It affects every organ of your body because it affects all of the blood vessels.
Right.
The small blood vessels are affected by this metabolic process. And this starts before your blood sugar becomes abnormal. We know that even if you've had good fasting blood sugars and occasionally good hemoglobin A1C, which is a long-term blood sugar average, before they become abnormal, if you have this detectable insulin resistance that leads to the metabolic process of diabetes, damage has already started.
Correct. And that's why that's really important to be assessed. We actually gave out Valentine's, which we still have, for Valentine's Day, on the back of the Valentine, we have stressed to our patients, know your numbers, know your fasting blood sugar, know your total cholesterol, your LDL, your HDL, know your blood pressure, and know your waist size. All are very important to understand to take good care of yourself. Is that another caller?
I believe we have another caller. Hi, caller, are you there?
Yes, I want to thank you for taking my call, and I love your show, and I listen to it all the time, and this
thank
is my
you.
Own personal opinion, not because I'm his patient, but I do believe Dr. Popper is probably the best doctor in Southwest Florida. Saying that, I had six events with atrial fibrillation, and I was deemed a non-compliant patient and dropped by two heart doctors in Charlotte. And I ended up with Dr. Estrada, who ablated my heart, and he recommended Dr. Popper. And Dr. Popper has been my cardiologist for the last two or three years, and I'm very pleased with him. My my question is,
and can
as
I
an
just
alternative
say something,
to...
Caller, can I just interrupt for a moment?
Yes, ma'am.
And aren't you and aren't we blessed that we have such a great cardiologist?
Yes, ma'am.
But go ahead with your question.
I can't compliment both your judgments.
The medications that I was on, I had six arterial atrial fibrillations until they finally figured out that these medications weren't working, and I had to get something else. And that's, like I said, I'm glad that I got Dr. Estrada, because he went through a bunch of stuff and figured out that I needed an ablation, not a pacemaker, which most of the cardiologists here said, well, you need a pacemaker. I said, no, we're going to try this ablation first because it's a new thing on the block. And I want to tell you right now, I'm at 2.5 years, and I have not had another atrial fibrillation in 2.5 years. And I thank you for your show. I listen every Friday, and I'll get off the phone now and let somebody else talk, and have a great weekend.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate your opinions. Certainly, we didn't get a question out of that, but... He did bring up the concept of ablation,
yes,
which is a technique by which we can use catheters to remove the source of an abnormal heart rhythm, so that it is possible to fix the abnormal heart rhythm by burning out in one fashion or another the source of that electrical abnormality. And that's the concept of ablation.
You know, a time is just speeding along. I haven't had a chance to ask my favorite question, which I'm just so happy that you're here. You're a great guest, but I always like to ask, what led you to become a doctor? What led you to choose this path?
Well, as we were discussing before, I guess I was a professional student for a long time. I found the acquisition of knowledge without a particular objective to achieve with that knowledge to be what I enjoyed the most. And I found, at the time I was in college, we started understanding the DNA molecule. Watson and Crick's book on the double helix had come out. And I found it fascinating. It kind of led me into an understanding of cell biology and the technology behind that. And all of that led me to a continuing understanding. If you were understanding cells, then think about the organs. If you were understanding the organs, think about how they were all put together. And I never really looked at it as becoming a doctor or thinking about getting a job. And you then asked me, how did I get to this? And I guess it was kind of an accident of birth. When my kids were born, I needed to get a job. So it became natural.
Well, you definitely have the gift. And that gift, because your mind is so knowledgeable, but you're also able to be a human. I think that's so important.
That's very important. Obviously, the delivery of medical care has become institutionalized and structured, and a financial process that is not really what healthcare should be all about. Healthcare is not a financial paradigm. It should be on a humanity basis.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we've made it a big business. Business we all participate in, but being a human, taking care of humans, is very important.
Yes, and with that beautiful philosophy, we will go ahead and say thank you to all. Stay healthy. Thank you, Dr. Paul Popper from the Center for the Performing Arts.
My pleasure. Dr. Triana, it's been a pleasure being here. It's a pleasure working with you, and it's a pleasure being able to help you take care of patients.
Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you, talking to you next week. Stay healthy, everyone.